program. We've got 5 lectures, most of which have to do with some aspect or another of the Economic Freedom of the World project that I and along with some co-authors work on. The first talk today is a pretty basic one, just an introduction to the Economic Freedom Index, how we do it, and some of the basic results. As we go on for the next few weeks, we'll have more detailed, in-depth discussions. We're going to talk about how economic freedom impacts growth, talk about human rights violations in economic freedom. That one might be pretty interesting. We're going to take on Naomi Klein on that one. That's always fun. We're going to talk a little bit about economic freedom and democracy, particularly looking at the views of Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek on the relationship between economic freedom and democracy. And then at the end of the 5 weeks, we're going to look at a very special project that I've just started, which is looking at the freedom of mobility. It's a beginning, it's an early stage project about how we should be thinking about the freedom of people to move around the world in sort of travel sense. So it's going to be, hopefully be interesting. Feel free to send questions to the question and answer utility there, and on we go here. So again, my name is Robert Lawson. I've just joined the faculty at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. I have a really cool title, the Jerome M. Fullenweider Chair in Economic Freedom. If you don't know who Jerry Fullenweider is, I should mention that Jerry Fullenweider is a Texas oil man, but more importantly, he is a founding board member of the Institute for Humane Studies, which some of you may be familiar with in Washington, D.C., and the IHS has been doing great work with student programs for 50 years, and Jerry Fullenweider was actually on the board at the very first year, and he's been continuously on the board for 50 years, and it's nice that he has donated some money to Southern Methodist University for me to be here. All right, so as I said, I'm going to talk about the Economic Freedom Index. Hopefully this will work. Okay. I probably should have changed this particular slide and shown Mises on the left-hand side there. When I usually give this talk to a more general audience, though, I like to start off the conversation by asking people to think about how we've had this sort of great debate between advocates of liberty, advocates of what Adam Smith called a system of natural liberty, and advocates, on the other hand, of some kind of planned society, some kind of socialist planned society. And sort of using, I use Smith and Marx as sort of straw men here, but I think in broad terms, Smith and the intellectual heirs that Smith begat, like you can go on to John Stuart Mill, you go on to Alfred Marshall, certainly the Austrian school, all in one degree or another follow in Smith's basic view that a system based on individual liberty, or again what Smith called natural liberty, that system would work better. I don't imagine that at the Mises Academy I have to spend a lot of time describing what we mean by a system of natural liberty. But of course, just to be complete, you know, we're talking about a system of private property, a system of free trade, voluntary exchange, a system of monetary security, and on and on. Of course, there's a lot of details to be ironed out in that system, but that's one side of the debate. And then on the other side of the debate, we have, as a sort of standard bearer, Karl Marx. Of course, there are a lot of other people that we could talk about in that same context. Continuing on into the 19th century, Thorstein Veblen, in the 20th century, John Kenneth Galbraith, perhaps even Keynes, certainly Paul Krugman today, I suppose. And in one way or another, this side of the debate advocates some very important role for central planning, and invariably that central planning, as you all know, is central planning done by governments. Okay, so we have these two schools of thought, and I don't know about you, but when I was a young student, a college student, this is 25 years ago, I was an early advocate of Adam Smith. I read Adam Smith. I also read Hayek. I read Mises, Milton Friedman, the various intellectual heroes to the market-oriented view of the world. And it sang to me. It made sense to me. I think on its face, Smith is obviously correct that a system of natural liberty works pretty well. I must say, however, that many of my friends in college, and probably most of your friends, were not immediately drawn towards a system of economic liberty or economic freedom. Most of my friends were socialists of one stripe or another. Most of them were highly skeptical of the role of markets and freedom and self-interest to get things done properly, and they almost always argued for more government control and regulation of society. And I remember having great debates, and you probably have these debates with your friends, and most of the debates that I remember from my college years were sort of like the panel you see on the left there, a name-calling exercise. I would sit with my friends deep in the evening, drinking beer or wine, and asking and telling friends, you know, markets work. I would say, markets work. If you let people alone, if we have free trade, things will work better. And my friends would say, no, it doesn't. And my friends would respond to me and says, you know, all we need is planning. And I would reply, oh, no, it doesn't. And much of the debate that goes on between advocates of freer markets and advocates of more central planning, much of that debate is simply name-calling. It's one side calling the other dirty names. We call them dirty pinko commies. They call us greedy bastard capitalists or what have you. But it's name-calling. It's very ideological, and it's very, very heated. But I'd like to suggest that one approach to this debate that we rarely do is to consider ourselves as if we were natural scientists. Now, I know that economics is not a natural science. The behavior of molecules, the behavior of matter in the physical universe obeys mathematical rules, and they're very regular, and we can describe the movement of planets and atoms with great precision with the use of mathematics. And people are not like that. Human beings do not work with the same degree of regularity that we see in the natural world, natural sciences, and that's fine. But in terms of approach, I'd like to suggest that maybe we should act a little bit more like we're natural scientists. You know, when natural scientists have debates, and they frequently do, suppose they typically rely on empirical evidence to settle the dispute. If two chemists were having an argument, for example, about what would happen if you mixed a couple chemicals together, and one chemist says, well, if you mix the chemicals together, you'll get a smell of roses, and another chemist says, no, you'll get a smell of rotten eggs, you can be sure that these two chemists are not going to argue in their hallways of their university departments for decades or centuries. At some point or another, they're going to go down the hallway to the laboratory. They're going to mix the two chemicals together, and they're going to see what happens. If the chemicals smell like roses, then the one guy is right. If they smell like rotten eggs, then the other guy is right. At the end of the day, natural science arrives at conclusions primarily through an appeal to empirical evidence. In the social sciences, frequently, however, we don't get to that point. We just argue about it. So I'd like to, with the Economic Freedom Project that I want to talk about, try to move us in the direction of using empirical evidence, more empirical evidence, to help us advance this debate about whether freer markets work or central planning works. So with that, let's move on a little bit to measuring economic freedom. At the end of the day, we have, in broad terms, two sides. One side says economic freedom, or if you will, natural liberty, or if you want to be political, you could say libertarianism, whatever word you choose to use, we choose to use the phrase economic freedom. Ultimately, one side's economic says economic freedom works. Economic freedom meaning personal choice, freedom to trade domestically, freedom to trade with foreigners, freedom to enter and compete in markets, and very importantly, property rights, private property rights. One side says if you have this, it works. Society works better. We get richer, we're happier, we live longer, we're healthier, whatever, however you define works. One side says economic freedom works. In order to evaluate this, we need a measure of economic freedom, and that's what the project is all about. Sure, economic freedom is complicated, it's complex, but I think it can be measured within some degree of accuracy. We measure a lot of things that are hard to measure. I'm not a huge fan of GDP, but we do measure it, and I think that in the broadest terms, GDP captures how much we produce. And if you look at the GDP over time, or if you compare the GDP of one country with another, bearing in mind there are measurement complications, the fact of the matter is GDP is complicated, but we measure it, and it seems to do a pretty good job for us. So we want to measure economic freedom. If we measure economic freedom, we can get some kind of scale for economic freedom. Then we can start to ask ourselves questions like, do places that have more economic freedom do better, or do they do worse than places that have less? So that's the goal of the project. So let me describe how we do it. Basically what I do with my co-authors, I should mention my co-authors, they're Jim Gwortney, who's at Florida State University, and now Josh Hall, who's at Beloit College in Wisconsin. We collect data. Before I go on, I want to throw out a little bone to our former colleague, Walter Block. Walter Block, of course, is highly influential at the Mises Institute. And Walter was, along with Jim and myself, one of the original authors of the Economic Freedom of the World project. Walter went on to other things as Jim and I continued the project, but I do want to make sure that everybody knows that Walter Block is really one of the most important intellectual fathers of the Economic Freedom of the World project, and we would quite literally, it's true, we would not have gotten the project off the ground without Walter's inspiration in those early years, some 20 years ago. So anyway, as I say, the methodology of the project is data-driven. We collect data for 141 countries. There are 42 different variables or components that are used in the index. They're grouped into five areas, which I'll mention briefly in a moment. Essentially, what we do is we take those 42 different variables, though, and we convert them to 0 to 10 index numbers, and 10 would be an indicator of higher economic freedom, and 0 would be less economic freedom. The data are all from third-party or external sources. We get our data from the World Bank and the IMF, private groups like the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Report, PricewaterhouseCoopers. There's a group in New York called PRS Group, which is a private consulting firm. So our data come from a mix of public and private sources, but the key to us is they're all publicly available. All of you with the right amount of effort could go to the original sources that we use and construct your own economic freedom index if you chose to. Much of the data we use are objective, things like tax rates, tariff rates, inflation rates. They're hard numbers. You just look them up in a book, it's a number. However, some of the data we use are survey driven. There are two or three different surveys that are given around the world. And they're useful for helping us figure out how countries are doing in different areas that we don't measure very well with sort of hard objective data. If you look at the report itself, and I'll give you the address for that later, and I know that you have some readings on the side, so you can certainly see it there. But if you look at the report, you'll see that all of the numbers are printed in the book, and one of the things I always like to mention is that transparency is a highly valued part of the project. We want everybody who uses the index to know where the numbers came from, how we did the method, how we converted the 0 to 10s, how we aggregated the index, and on and on. We thought it was very important from a credibility point of view that people know we're just not making the data up ourselves. So that's the broadly how the index is put together. It's a data collection exercise from lots of different places. In terms of the broad areas, I mean, I think 42 variables would be an awful lot for us to go through one by one. We'd be here for several hours probably looking at each one individually. But most people do when they look at the index, however, they look at one at the five broad areas. So each of the 42 variables is put into one of these five areas. And so in order to do well on the index, at the end of the day, what you need to do is to do well in if not all, most of these five areas. So the five areas are first, size of government in a fiscal sense. Here we're measuring basically the size of government in terms of government spending, how big is government consumption expenditures, government transfer payments, government investment spending. We also have a variable in there on marginal tax rate. So this is government's spending in the purely fiscal sense. Obviously, countries like Scandinavian countries would score very poorly here. The higher your government spending, the less economic freedom. So Scandinavian countries tend to score pretty poorly here. many other countries with lower taxes would score much better. The second area is legal structure. It's property and property rights. It's basically the security of property rights. Many of these variables are survey-based, but there's seven different variables here from three different sources. We measure from surveys. There are simple questions on international surveys that say the wording is very straightforward. It says, how security or property is property in your country? People rate that on a sort of some kind of scale. We convert to a 0 to 10 scale. There's some information in there in the second area on how long it takes to settle a contract dispute. Because one of the most important parts of property rights is the ability to settle quickly and efficiently disputes between parties in contract. So that's the second area. The third area is access to sound money. Now, the reality is, as much as most of us probably don't like it, governments control the money supply in essentially every country in the world. And so if you were, but what we do here is we really don't measure the structure of the monetary system in terms of its consistency with Rothbardian or other sorts of concerns. What we really do is measure the results here. And so countries that have low inflation and stable inflation, countries that are able to assure their citizens of some security in their financial holdings, they get better ratings here. So we have measures of inflation, the standard deviation of inflation. We also have some measures in here of whether you're allowed to own a bank account in another currency, things like that. That's the third area. The fourth area is a big area on freedom to trade internationally. It has several variables measuring tariffs, a couple variables measuring non-tariff barriers like quotas. It has some capital control measures as well. And so that's the fourth area. And the fifth area, the big one, it has all kinds of different regulations in different areas, credit market regulations, labor market regulations like minimum wages, hiring and firing restrictions, things like severance pay, for example. In the credit market area, we have things like whether you have interest rate controls. In the general business regulation area, we have price controls, some information on price controls that we use. We have some information on how long it takes to start a business and how many regulatory hurdles there are to start a business and things like that. So we have those 42 variables, but they're housed in one of these five areas. And all of those 0 to 10 variables are averaged up into these five areas, and then these five areas in turn are averaged to get a final economic freedom index score. Now, if this was a live audience, I'd ask everybody if you know who number one is. Many people throw out names, and it's quite surprising how wrong they are. But if you're a student of economic freedom, it's no surprise to you that Hong Kong scores number one on the index. On our 10-point scale, when you average up all of those variables into those five areas and then average those five areas, we find that Hong Kong gets about a 9 out of 10 on our index scale. And Hong Kong is hardly an anarcho-capitalist paradise from an anarcho-capitalist point of view. They have taxes in Hong Kong. They're very low, however. I think the top marginal tax rate is 25%, but basically they run a 15% flat tax, and there's no payroll tax, there are no tariffs and quotas. Inflation is a trivial concern in Hong Kong. Regulations are very, very light in Hong Kong. They just passed their first minimum wage, I think, and it was like $2.50 an hour or something like that. It's very, very low by world standards. So Hong Kong scores number one, and that's not much of a surprise to most people. Perhaps a little bit of a surprise is number two, Singapore. Singapore scores number two, and they always have scored number two. We actually have data all the way back to the 70s for most of these countries. And Hong Kong and Singapore are basically number one and two throughout the entire last 30 or 40 years. Singapore coming in second affords me the chance to mention that our index is really narrow, only looking at economic liberty in the narrowest sense of that term. We're not looking at civil liberties protections here. That's not because we don't think those things are important, but rather it's because there are other indexes of civil liberties out there, such as the Freedom House Index of Civil Liberties. Amnesty International does kind of some various scoring and so on. So we don't feel the need to get involved in that. So Singapore is a very free place, relatively speaking, to do business. You can open a business. There is very low taxes, very few regulations, monetary risk is low. But it's not really, of course, a great place to criticize the government. So Singapore is quite unusual in that it has a fairly high degree of economic liberty, but not so much political or civil liberty. But with that aside, most of the rest of the countries here in the top 10, you'll see, are liberal democracies as well. Chile is in the top 10. It doesn't have a huge history of political liberalism, but today, of course, Chile is relatively liberal in a democratic sense as well. The United States is 10th on the index, and this is somewhat newsworthy this year. In last year's index, which represented the year 2008, this year's index represents the year 2009. We're always about 2 years behind with our data because it takes that long for all the data to percolate up to our offices. But anyway, the United States is 10th. We were 6th last year, and we were as high as 3rd in the year 2000. So the United States has been undergoing a very rapid decline on our index from 3rd to 6th, now to 10th. And I project that if looking outside my window, it looks like the United States is going to continue to slide. Many people think that assume that the U.S.'s rating is falling because of government spending, and that's true. Government spending in the United States is up. Total government spending in the United States is up by about 20-30%. But the biggest decline for the United States is in the second area of the Economic Freedom Index. It's in the area of property rights. If you look at the U.S. scores in the property rights area, the question, for example, on the security of property rights, which we get from a survey, that's that question, the rating used to be like a 7 or 8, and now it's like a 4. So very, very large declines in a number of different areas in that second area on property rights. So the U.S. has clearly slipped. If the U.S. ever was regarded as one of the most free market countries in the world, I think it's fair to say that that's no longer the case. And I think that as the next several years unfold, we're probably likely to see continuing declines. We'll have to wait for the data to come in. Now, I'm going to look at some other countries next. You know, with 141 countries, I'm afraid there's quite a bit too many to put on a slide like this. You're welcome to look at the reading. You can look at all the countries. But here are a list of some of the larger and perhaps more significant countries around the world. The color codings here represent quartiles. So the blue, if a country is noted in blue, that means it's in the top 25%, the green is the second 25%, and so on. So the red countries are in the bottom 25%. If you look at this list, maybe there are some surprises, perhaps not. Some people are surprised to see some of the social welfare countries of Western Europe, like Sweden, score as highly as they do. And I think that we sometimes forget that although Sweden has a lot more government spending and higher taxes, in a structural sense, Sweden is more similar to the market economies of the United States than they are dissimilar. Most people in Sweden work in private companies. The products are sold in markets without much regulation, except for labor markets. But there's no price controls in Sweden, for example, to speak of. The trade is quite free. You can import and export in and out of Sweden quite freely. Monetary risk is low in Sweden, relatively low, and on and on. If you look at Sweden and compare it to the United States, you'd find that Sweden has higher taxes and they have some more serious labor market regulations than the United States. But in many ways, structurally, Sweden is more similar to the United States than I think we realize. And that's why you see Sweden scores right about on the border between the blue and the green there. It's just below the 25th percentile on the index. You know, a lot of quite people ask about China. You can see China scores very low on our index still. It's 92nd out of 141. It's well below the median. To be sure, China has come up a lot in the index. They've increased their rating a lot over the time frame we've shown. But it's really hard to rate China because there's so many different, so much variation inside of China. Inside of China, you have relatively free market, freewheeling Shanghai, but at the same time, you have tightly controlled outer provinces where the Communist Party really still runs things with an iron hand. So at the end of the day, we're only allowed to give one number to each country, and China ends up with a fairly low rating. It has gone up a lot, but it's still pretty low. It is simply incorrect to call China a market economy today. It's still a government-run economy in most respects. And the same is true of India. India has come up in the indexes a lot, but as you can see, India scores still very, very low on the index. At the very, very bottom, we have a couple sort of tragic cases. Probably don't need to talk to you all in too much detail about Venezuela, but Venezuela, as recently as 1980, was ranked quite highly on the index. In 1980, I think they were ranked 22nd in the whole world out of over 100 countries. Today, Venezuela is near the bottom of the index, almost dead last. I think the only country below it is Myanmar and Venezuela. Venezuela is also a tragic case, as you might know. 20 or 30 years ago, Venezuela would have been a relatively high-functioning country, but Zimbabwe today is really quite a disaster. So as I say, there's way too many countries for us to list them all out and talk about them individually. I can, however, I think it's maybe nice to look at a map, a sort of picture representation. Last year we did a poster like this, and this is based on last year's data, but it's pretty much the same. If you can see, the United States and Canada are in blue. This is always a nice part to look at, is to look at Chile and Argentina. Chile is in the top 10, as you know, and Argentina is in the bottom 25%, and that's really quite a stark contrast. In Africa, you can see Southern Africa, South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Zambia scoring relatively high, and then Kenya scoring relatively high as well. But most of Africa scoring pretty poorly. If you look at the former Soviet republics, some neat things are going on here. It may be hard to see, but you see that country right there I'm pointing to. That's Georgia. The Republic of Georgia is ranked 27th on the index, and that's a shocking change. You know, 20 years ago, the Republic of Georgia was the Soviet Socialist Republic of Georgia. part of the Soviet Union. Indeed, Georgia has been part of the Russian Empire for over 200 years, has almost no history of independence from Russia. In 1980, they gained their independence. They struggled mightily for 10 years, but about 10 years ago, after the Rose Revolution there, they began easily the most rapid economic reforms in the entire world. At the same time, some of the former Soviets, like Ukraine, they're still at the bottom of the mix. So, you know, you're seeing incredible amounts of diversity in the former Soviet republics. Georgia, Estonia doing very well. Ukraine doing very poorly. Some of the Central Asian countries are doing surprisingly well, such as Kazakhstan, and so on. You can see a lot of countries are not rated because we're data-driven. We can't rate some countries that we'd like to rate. We don't rate Cuba. Now, I have no doubt where Cuba goes on the index. They go probably right below Zimbabwe. We also don't rate North Korea because of lack of data. Again, I have no doubt where North Korea goes. North Korea belongs at the bottom of any economic freedom index. But we don't want to rate countries unless we have data. That was sort of the rule we made some 20 years ago with Walter Block and Jim Gortney. We just wanted to have data for things. So we know where North Korea and Cuba probably belong, but because of lack of data, we don't include them in our index. And that's unfortunate, but that's the way we go with our index. In next year's report, in the 2012 report, I'm hoping to be able to include a number of these countries. I'm hoping to include Saudi Arabia. I'm hoping to include some more of the Central Asian, like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, perhaps Belarus will be included in the index. It's doubtful, however, that I'll ever be able to include North Korea until major regime change occurs. Same thing for Cuba. I want to be able to rate Libya soon, but I don't think that'll happen for a few years either. So you can see we still have some gaps in the index, but most of the world is covered. So remember what we were trying to do with the Economic Freedom Index was get this index together and try to assign scores to countries. And countries that score higher on the index, that indicates that they're using more markets. They're more free. They have lower taxes. They have better property rights. They have more stable money, freer trade, and less regulations. Again, no country is perfect here. This is a very relative scale. Walter Block used to say at the early stages of this project, he used to say, Lawson, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We're going to measure it. We're going to measure it as well as we can, but we know no country's perfect, and we're going to be drawing distinctions amongst shades of gray. So at the end of the day, though, we have this scale. Countries that are blue are more free. Countries that are green are in the next tier and on down into the red group. And the idea, again, the purpose of this index was to be empirical and to ask, okay, now that we have some kind of scale, some kind of measure of which places in the world are more market-oriented, more free, if you will, do they look better? Are they better off or are they worse off? Well, I'm going to skip that. I'll come back to that maybe. Well, they do look better. With the data that we have available, it's quite easy to show, for example, that countries that score higher on the Economic Freedom Index, in fact, have higher incomes. They're richer. Using GDP per capita data, the best data we have available, and I know all the complaints that people might have about GDP per capita, but whatever measurement error exists in GDP per capita is relatively small compared to the differences across the world. If you look at the countries that are blue on that map, their average income is over $30,000 a person, whereas the countries that are red on that map, their average income is just about $4,500 per person. So you're looking at about an 8-to-1 difference between the blue countries and the red countries, and that's not attributable just to measurement error. That's quite real. It's quite significant. Now, again, not every country that's blue is rich. Georgia is a blue country. Georgia's Republic of Georgia is ranked, as I said, 27th. And I think their income is on the order of $3,000 to $5,000. It's not very high. But generally speaking, it's easy to show now that countries that are more free are richer. Now, that probably doesn't surprise any of you. But it probably would have surprised you if you were a student of economics in the 1960s. This slide here shows a couple pictures. Look at the one on the left. If you look at the one on the left, at the bottom we have years. We have 1960, 1970, and on up to 2000. On the vertical axis, it says relative growth rates, but really it's income levels measured on a log scale. And it says that for the United States, the income level at the beginning of the period in 1960 was about 100. And then it was about 50 for the Soviet Union, for the USSR. And the person who drew this graph was projecting that from 1960 forward, the United States would grow, the USSR would grow, but the USSR would grow faster. And that sometime in the, sometime around 1990 or so, the Soviet Union would probably pass the United States in terms of its income level. Well, of course, this is shockingly bad, right? Shockingly wrong. Many of you might know that the graph that I'm showing here is from Paul Samuelson's Economics Principles textbook. The graph on the left is from, I believe it's the 1964 edition of Samuelson's Principles textbook. On the right, this is a graph, it's exactly the same graph, you can see it's identical, he did change the dates, but it's an identical graph from about 10 years later, sometime in the mid-1970s. So Paul Samuelson, one of the smartest economists to ever live, a person whose textbook taught literally an entire generation of college students about economics. He projected that the Soviet Union would grow more rapidly, and by the time we reached the 1990s, or certainly by the time we reach today, the Soviet Union would be richer than the United States. Well, that's shockingly wrong. It's horribly bad. The picture that we saw a second ago, which most of us think makes tremendous sense, was in fact not obvious to economists, really smart, Nobel Prize winning economists a generation ago. A generation ago, this was the standard view of how markets and centrally planned economies operated. The standard view of Paul Samuelson and his generation was that markets would not perform better than central planning. Central planning would outperform markets, and they were wrong. We now know they were wrong because we have the data. We have the data on market-oriented countries from the Economic Freedom Index, and we have data on GDP. So, Paul Samuelson was wrong. We now know that. Anybody who argues that central planning outperforms markets, it's not a matter of ideological dispute. It's simply factually wrong. And that's an important piece of knowledge for us to all have. Now, if you are debating with people that like central planning, they probably these days will admit, perhaps grudgingly, but they will admit that economic freedom or markets outperform central planning in terms of income. But their complaint will fall back. Their fallback complaint is, yeah, markets work, but they leave people behind. They hurt the poor. And the income distribution is unequal. So what I have here is a slide showing you the economic freedom ratings, again, by quartile, and the share of income going to the poorest 10%. This is the share of total income earned by the bottom of the income distribution. And as you can see, it's pretty much a horizontal line. Whether you're in a red country or a yellow country or green or a blue, it turns out that the poorest tenth of the population earns somewhere between 2.5%, perhaps 2 to 3% of income. It's in fact not true that countries that are more economically free have more income inequality. It's not true. We have the data. We know it's not true. Many people cling to the myth that markets and economic liberty harms the poor and hurts the income distribution, but it's not true. We really don't need to argue about the ideology here. It's factually not true. And that's a beautiful thing about this, about the data that we have. We don't have to argue and engage people with deep philosophical discussions about markets and inequality. All we have to do is show them a picture. And I think it changes the way which we debate people who like central planning. Of course, the level of income, not the share, but the level of income earned by the poorest 10% is quite much higher in the blue countries. This is really a mirror image of the very first chart that I showed, but it's worth remembering that if you are in the bottom tenth of an income distribution, you are far better off in absolute terms if you find yourself in an economically free country. The average income of the poorest tenth in economically free countries is nearly $9,000 compared to about $1,000 in those red countries. So the share of income is pretty much the same everywhere. But the level of income earned by the poorest 10% is much higher in economically free countries. And for those people who claim to really care about the poor and the downtrodden, this is a very powerful picture, in my opinion. It's one of my favorites. Although my favorite is really this one. I like the life expectancy picture the most. It's really, it really gets us beyond talking about money. If you look at the life expectancy, again, by quartile, what you see is about a 20-year difference between a 20-year gap between the blue and the reds. That's a huge difference. I mean, the difference between living to be 80 versus living to be 60 is a very important difference. It's not just about how many Volvos you have in your driveway or how many villas you have or whatever. If you're in a blue country, you are probably going to live into your 80s. You're probably going to see your grandchildren born. You're probably going to see your grandchildren grow up, and your grandchildren get married, and you're probably going to see your great-grandchildren. If you are in a country that has very little economic freedom, you are probably going to be dead, statistically, before you see your grandchildren. Well, certainly before you see them grow up. And the odds of you seeing your great-grandchildren are essentially zero. So it's about more than money. It's about the quality of life, the length of life, but also the quality of that life. I can go on and show a lot of charts. I will only show a few more, and then perhaps we'll have some additional questions from you all in conversation. But the economic freedom and female literacy. I can also do this for males, but we wanted to highlight the fact that females who are in fact disadvantaged in many countries, that females show better social outcomes in more economically free countries. This is the rate of extreme poverty. Extreme poverty is measured in this graph as $2 a day. So roughly 700 hours a year. And so this is the percentage of the population that lives in extreme poverty. And as you can see in the countries that are red, the lowest quartile countries, 2 out of 5 people live in what we call extreme poverty. In the blue countries, it's essentially zero. I mean, there's a few countries where you have some extreme poverty, but in most of those blue countries, the amount of extreme poverty is absolutely zero. So that's something for people who really claim to care about the poorest of the society. This is an important, I think, picture to keep in mind. So I've got a lot of graphs like this. I can show you graphs for democracy that show that more economic freedom correlates with democracy. I actually don't have it in today's slide because we're going to talk about democracy and economic freedom in more detail later on in the series. I do want to mention that we have a website. Please forgive the website name. It was made up some years ago. I'm not sure who made it up, but they called it freetheworld.com. I personally don't care for the name. But if you go to our website, it's freetheworld.com, you can download the report. And, you know, the report is, if you see it, here, I'll show you, it looks like this. Okay. You can download and print the report. And there are chapters in the report, special chapters in each report. In addition to all the data and numbers that I've described, there are special chapters. This year's chapters, we have one from a World Bank economist that looks at economic growth and compares economic growth with economic freedom and also democracy. And he shows that economic freedom is more important than democracy for growth. If you look at this year's report, there's a chapter by an economist named Michael Stroup. He has a chapter on female development that's quite nice. In earlier years, you can go back and look at other years' reports. We have special chapters on war. Chris Coyne and Russ Sobel have a chapter on how economic freedom spreads around the world. So each year's edition has really interesting research that we have pulled together from other scholars showing how economic freedom correlates and corresponds to all kinds of different things. And it's very exciting to see how the Economic Freedom Index has been put to use. So with that, I think I am done with my main presentation about the index. I've been trying not to look at the chat over on the right because it's a little distracting when I'm doing the talk. I can see somebody's talking about Harrison Bergeron, which is a favorite short story of mine. In fact, Walter Block was the first person to show me that short story. But at this point, if there are any questions, you can hit a question and answer, and I'll try to answer as best I can. Okay. All right, so actually that's good. We have a question from the chat on how our index compares to the one at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you. Well, the Heritage Foundation has an Index of Economic Freedom. That's the title of it. It's the Index of Economic Freedom. And it's co-sponsored with Dow Jones, Wall Street Journal. In a nutshell, well, let me go back up. I don't think that I and the co-authors of the Economic Freedom of the World Index and the people at the Fraser Institute, which is our primary publisher, or the Cato Institute in the United States, which is our primary U.S. partner, I don't think any of us have any grand philosophical disagreements with the people at the Heritage Foundation about what economic freedom means. You know, Bill Beach, who is one of the primary movers of the Heritage Foundation, is a close friend of mine, and I think he and I both, when we say the term economic freedom, we have in our minds the same concept. The difference in the index, our index, which some people call the Fraser Index, I call it the Gortney Lawson Hall Index myself. But the difference between our index and the Heritage Index is primarily methodological. Again, we made the early decision with Walter Block to be a data-driven index, to be transparent so that the raw data would be transparently transformed into 0 to 10s. The 0 to 10s would be aggregated again in a transparent way. And any one of you who looks at the book can see quite clearly how the index numbers that we arrive at were arrived at. And you can check the raw numbers that we use. And you know, I get emails all the time where people correct mistakes that we've made because of some kind of problem in the databases. But the Heritage Foundation's index, for lack of a better term, is a little bit more of I could call it a beauty contest, but it's really a panel of experts. The people at the Heritage Foundation, Bill Beach and his staff, they look at a lot of data. They're not making the thing, they're not just shooting blind. But they look at a lot of data and they read a lot of accounts for a lot of countries. But at the end of the day, they assign their ratings somewhat more subjectively than we do. And so the methodology is just quite different. Very rarely do we have big disagreements. So if you compare our index with theirs, Hong Kong is number one in theirs, Hong Kong is number one in ours. the U.S. has been falling in ours. It's been falling in theirs. I think in their index, the U.S. is ninth now, and now ours is 10th. So there's broad agreement between the two index. There are some individual countries that we rate higher and than they do, or vice versa. But in the grand scheme of things, their index, even though it's done quite differently in terms of its methodology than ours, we have sort of broad agreement in most of the countries. So that's it. I don't really pay much attention to the index, to the Heritage Index. Yes. I've got a question. Yeah, I think you all can see the chat. So, and there's a question about the mean rating. So that was the slide I skipped. Let me go back. Right. So, yes, the questions are about how the aggregate level of freedom has changed over the years. And this is a chart that is in the report every year. It tracks the average, global average for economic freedom from 1980 to the year 2009. Again, 2009 is the last year we have data. I should mention this is for the same set of countries. So there's about 100 countries in the index all the way back to 1980. So this is the same 100 countries. So it's not like the bases are not changing here. It's the same set of countries. So in 1980, you can see the average index rating was 5.53. And that crept up a little bit by 85. But you can see the real growth in the late 80s and into the 90s. And this was the period that many people, you know, called the Washington Consensus. This was the Commanding Heights era. This is the era during which global tariff rates were falling as a result of World Trade Organization efforts, or the old GATT. This is the era in which marginal tax rates were falling around the world. In most countries in the world, in most countries in the world, marginal tax rates have been falling. One of the real silent revolutions around the world that my co-author Josh Hall just did an article on Econ Live for David Henderson is conscription, military conscription, which is one of the most egregious kinds of violations of freedom, where they physically take you and make you work for the army. Conscription has been falling all around the world. It's one of the most quiet, I think most significant moves towards economic liberty in the entire world. Is dozens and dozens of countries have dropped conscription. France used to have it. They don't have it anymore. A lot of countries in Africa have actually dropped it. It's been a shocking thing to see. It's really wonderful to see. So the 80s, you see the index numbers increasing. Right about 2000, though, it begins to level off. 2005, it's the average is 6.9. In the last 2 years, the global average has fallen just a little bit. You can see the number has gone down a little bit in 2009. So the era of the Washington Consensus, the era of freer trade and privatization, lowered marginal tax rates, that era came to a conclusion, according to our data, sometime in the mid-2000s. And so it's really a shame, I suppose, I think, anyway. I think it's a shame, anyway, to see that trend not continuing upward. So there's a question about the U.S. and property rights. Let me look at my book real quick, because I think I want to give you some numbers on this. So for the United States, in the property rights area that we have, we have one, and the first three I have to talk about are all from the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Report. Now, again, the Global Competitiveness Report is not an economic freedom index, but some of the questions are quite good from our point of view. And the World Economic Forum is certainly not a libertarian outfit. We all know this. But they have survey questions. For example, they have one question on how independent is the judiciary from the political process? In the year 2000, the United States had a rating of 8.02, and in 2009, it's 6.6. So we've dropped by 1.3 points. Impartial courts. How impartial are the courts? The rating was a 9, and now it's a 5.7. That's a drop of over 3 points. In the question about the generic protection of property rights, this is a survey question. The U.S. was at 9.1 in 2000. Now we're at a 6.8. You know, it's pretty hard when you look at those surveys to know exactly what's in the minds of the survey respondents. But something clearly has happened since 2000 that those people filling those surveys at, and those are surveys given to hundreds of people. They're not thousands of people, but a lot of people fill these surveys out. And from year to year, it's frequently the same people. So what we're seeing is people are slowly, over the last 10 years, are putting much lower ratings for the U.S. in these areas. I don't know exactly what it is. It could be the Kelo decision, the eminent domain decision in the Supreme Court. I think it could be tighter enforcement of drug laws, which are threats on property. You know, the asset forfeiture laws, where if you have $1,000 in your car, they take your $1,000, and just on the mere suspicion that it's drug related. I think it's the war on terrorism, taking your shoes off at airports, stories about warrantless wiretaps, stories about torture in Guantanamo. I think it's a whole bunch of things where people feel more unsettled in their property, in their security, their persons, and their places. There's a question also in there about from a different source, from the PRS group, which is a different source. One is on military interference in the political process. That rating used to be a 10 out of 10, and now it's a 6.6 out of 10. There's another question on rule of law from the PRS group. That rating used to be a 10, and now it's an 8. So again, it's not just that one source is showing lower ratings. It's a multiple sources from in different formats. It's pretty hard to pinpoint, but I think it's quite real. Somebody's asking a question about. The psychological perception plays a large role in the surveys. Yes. For better or worse, many of the areas when we're talking about property rights and regulations and the importance of regulation, they're pretty hard to measure with hard data, with statistics, if you will. So we're forced to rely on perception-based surveys. And I've kind of come around, though. The more I've worked with the surveys, the more comfortable I've become with them. They seem to, for the most part, be pretty accurate. They track trends pretty well. And in a cross-country sense, they seem to make sense. So although they're more subjective, they're harder for us to evaluate than the empirical data that we get, like inflation rates or tariff rates. I'm pretty comfortable with the surveys now. They're not perfect. I'd rather have hard data, to be sure. But I think that they're a necessary part of the project. This is a great question. How do lefties respond to indexes like this, since the data seem to clearly repudiate their worldview? That's a great question. I have a really mean-spirited talk that I give sometimes where I sort of attack the left and I say, well, you know, what's wrong with these people? I mean, look at this chart. More economic freedom, you live longer. More economic freedom. I've got a great chart on economic freedom and happiness. You've heard of these happiness indexes. I'm not a big fan of them, but there are these happiness scales out there. And guess what? More economic freedom means people are happier, too. Countries that are blue have higher self-reported levels of happiness than the countries that are red. And so all these areas where the data and the statistics, they show that economic freedom is a good thing. I mean, even on the term, I mean, that the left should appreciate. For the most part, they ignore the index, and that's unfortunate. There are some indexes that are, there's a. The second question was, are there any comparable indexes? There is something out there that I just saw called some kind of a sustainability index, and it was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. In fact, in the sustainability index, you'll have to Google it to find it. I think it's called sustainability index. They actually included GDP per capita in the index, but they counted it negative. If you had more GDP per capita, you had lower scores on the sustainability index, which I think is pretty bizarre, frankly. Well, the result, of course, turns out to be very bizarre, because all these really horrible basket case countries, countries that no one thinks as being high functioning countries that anybody really wants to live in, sustainability index. So it was a joke. I actually thought it was hilarious that they would put together an index where these really awful, poor, and just devastatingly backward places would score high on their index, and, you know, where, I mean, it, for us at least, we've got some pretty good countries at the top, you know, Hong Kong and Singapore and Canada, the United States, the countries in the top 10 in our index are pretty doggone livable places to be. So, you know, they're not perfect. I would like to see a lot more economic freedom in all of those countries, but you have to admit they're pretty livable. They're a lot more livable than the countries at the bottom of the list. So, you know, I think that's exactly the point of the index. This index should force people on the left to, you know, to sort of face the reality that their views, as comfortable as those views may be in their minds, they don't hold up well to any kind of empirical scrutiny. Are there any other questions? What do we got here? I'm perhaps missing some. Yeah, not, let me see. Yeah. Are there any other questions for me? Okay. Yes, Kevin, that's very good. There are certainly much more sophisticated ways to show the data. To be honest, this is the kind of slideshow presentation I give to lay audiences, most frequently groups of college freshmen and such, Rotary clubs and the like, and something more sophisticated than bar charts would tend to leave the audience behind. I understand that this is a more sophisticated group. Perhaps, and you'll find that when we get into the later talks, the analysis gets a little bit more sophisticated and hopefully a little bit more satisfying to you. But at this point, let me just sort of assert, and you'll have to take it perhaps on faith at this point, but assert that, you know, when you do more sophisticated analysis, scattergrams, regression lines, when you do a multivariate regression controlling for other factors and so forth, that the patterns that we see here really don't go away very easily, even when you do more sophisticated analysis, which is really what you should do and what we do in our regular work. To publish things. Yeah, again, certainly if you were doing a study of life expectancy, you would want to include variables beyond just the Economic Freedom Index, and that's what we do. There's been a lot of work done on economic growth and income, and the growth literature especially, there's several dozen academically published studies, all of them using some type of multivariate regression in many of them very state-of-the-art econometric techniques that are trying to control for the various biases that might exist in these kinds of studies. And again, they're all showing that economic freedom corresponds to higher growth. And I think that's the next talk, actually, is economic freedom and growth. And we'll actually talk about how those studies are put together and what the basic results of those studies are. So I think you're absolutely right to bring that up, though. About any other questions? Matthew asks if there's been any other categories that really surprised me and that more economic freedom didn't result in the correlation you would have expected. Well, in terms of categories, Matthew, that's a very good question. You know, I some people have tried, and I have tried, and many other scholars have tried to look at the individual component parts, most often looking at the five areas. And I must say that right now, I think the academic work that's been done at the category level or the area level is still very unsettled. One thing we see is that, you know, if you do a simple correlation without controlling for anything else, area one, which is the size of government in a fiscal sense, you know, most of the countries that score high on that have big governments, most of the countries with big governments are also high income. So if you just do a correlation with area one, what you find is the countries that have the largest governments have the highest incomes. And some people have suggested that means that that our index doesn't work. Well, more sophisticated work has been done and on size of government. I think that the evidence there is, particularly over time, countries that have larger governments have in fact paid a price in terms of lower growth. But you don't see that in a simple cross-section at a point in time. So that's one thing that's a little bit, but even that's very unsettled. The five areas of the index are so highly correlated with each other that in fact it's very hard statistically to disentangle or separate the impact of one relative to the others. It's pretty hard to do. Some of the areas are very stable over time, like area two, the property rights area, doesn't move around much over time. So there isn't a lot of variation except cross countries, but there's not a lot of time series variation. So the econometrics at the individual category or area level are pretty tough, and there isn't really a consensus in terms of which areas matter the most or anything like that. I am always surprised, though. You asked me if I'm surprised. I have been very surprised at how robust the index has been when it's studying things that I didn't have a strong prior view about. One of my favorite areas of research that I've seen is work by a guy named Eric Gartsky. I'll type that because you all maybe can look him up. Eric Gartsky is a professor of political science at University of California, San Diego, which is a very top PhD program. And Eric does work on international conflict. And what his work is showing is that countries that have higher economic freedom scores are much, much, much less likely to have an international war than countries that have less. And he even controls for things like democracy. And what he finds is that democracy is, in fact, not a very strong predictor of whether you go to war or not. In fact, democracies, in his studies, go to war about as frequently as non-democracies. But he finds that it's economic freedom that really drives the result. He has a paper called The Capitalist Peace, which is pretty good, as in the American Political Science Review, a top journal. So I would not have really predicted. I wouldn't have a strong view going into it before I read his paper. I wouldn't have had a strong view of how that would turn out, frankly. I might have thought that democracy was more powerful than economic freedom when it came to things like war. There's a couple studies on pollution that are pretty interesting. One I just read, it was in the journal Ecological Economics, and it showed that countries with more economic freedom have less pollution. Again, that didn't strike me as immediately obvious, particularly when you look at some types of air pollution, which, you know, one of the realities of markets and production is the production of pollution. So market-oriented countries produce a lot. So it wasn't obvious to me that they would have less pollution, but in fact, it turns out that's the case. So there's some research out there that's pretty neat like that. Since this is the Mises Academy and Mises Institute, I did want to, I have no objection at all to the praxeological approach of Mises and Rothbard. I'm something of a sympathetic soul there. For me, the logic of markets, the pure logic of markets, makes a lot of sense. But one of the things that we have to admit with ourselves is that many, many, many people, probably most people, do not have not absorbed that logic. And many people are fundamentally consequentialist, or if you want to use the term utilitarian. And they really don't care about the logic or the philosophy. They care about results. And I think if we want to convince people that economic freedom is a good thing, the way we're going to do that for most people is not through an appeal to pure logic, as you would in, say, human action, but through an appeal to empirical evidence. That's to take nothing away from human action. To me, it's easily one of the most important books ever written, and it was highly persuasive to me. But I think we have to admit that most people are not persuaded by that type of argument. Sorry, my phone went off. I'm an imperialist. Yes, I am. About any more questions? Alicia, you asked about intellectual property. The short answer is no. Intellectual property is not included in there. There is a survey question on intellectual property, which I used to include in the index. Now, we included it in the index not out of any great love for IP, but because we saw it as a sort of proxy for other property. But when the survey question on property rights generally became available, we dropped intellectual property and substituted the regular property rights for that variable. And Walter Block, I mentioned him several times tonight, Walter Block would send me an annual email complaining about the intellectual property variable, and I'm very sympathetic to that argument. I'm not a big fan of intellectual property rights either. I'm not as hostile as some people, to be sure, but I'm not a fan. So at the end of the day, it was very nice for us to be able to drop that variable and use a more general non-intellectual property-based question. And so right now, there's nothing in the index that includes intellectual property. I'm happy about that. Jerry, thank you. There is an argument, indeed, that we won't persuade people with utilitarian arguments. I think you're right. Some people respond to moral argument more readily, and some people respond to utilitarian argument more readily. I don't think it's either or. I think we have to recognize the diversity of the people with whom we encounter in the world. I also think that moral arguments are more persuasive on some individual topics than others, for example. Just to give one example, I have found, at least in talking to people in the United States, that if you want to talk about drug legalization, for example, that a moral argument that people should be free, or they are free to do drugs on moral grounds, I find that argument falls on deaf ears most of the time. And that when I argue about drug legalization, I find it better to argue a more consequentialist argument with most people. The flip side is I know there are other arguments that the moral argument is more persuasive. So it goes both ways. And I think it depends a little bit on the person, but it also depends a little bit on the topic that we're talking about. Yeah, you know, I think that we should be careful. The word utilitarian has normative overtones. I think we should be talking about consequentialism. Me certainly And all of us make consequential arguments all the time. It's perfectly, I'm absolutely certain that in human action, the argument about a price control would be that if you put a price control on a product, you'll generate a shortage or a surplus. That's a consequence of price controls. And it's based on the logic of markets and how markets work, the logic of human action. Price controls generate shortages and surpluses. But that's a consequence of the policy. And I don't think we should be at all afraid to gather evidence demonstrating that consequence. And so that's I think, the point here. If we're going to say, if we do this, then this will happen, we should be able to show that it happens. Well, I think we're getting close to out of time. I'll respond to this last remark by Giri. You suggest that we can interpret statistical data any way you want. I'm going to suggest exactly the opposite. I work with statistical data every day of my life, and it's not that easy to manipulate. In fact, there are real patterns out there, and those real patterns are very, very hard to manipulate in practice. We're not talking about controlled experiments here. We're talking about actual things that have happened. We can measure when people are born, when they live. We can measure what tariff rates are, what inflation rates are, perhaps not with perfect precision. We can measure these things, and we can certainly look at how things correlate with each other. Not talking about making predictions out of sample or anything of that sort, but we make consequential arguments all the time, and we need, I think, to measure those. We need to use the evidence that we have available to demonstrate that the consequences are in accord with the theory that we have, and that's essentially what the project is trying to do. All right, well, you know, we're closing in out of time. Are there any other questions? Well, I'm not seeing a lot that, let's see. Well, I'll have to read those articles again. Utilitarianism is a little bit different than just pure consequentialism. Utilitarianism implies some measure of good as opposed to consequence. But I think we're probably on the same page there, Danny. Okay, well, I think we're pretty close to wrapped up then. I guess thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week, I guess.